Ever wondered why siblings raised in the same household can turn out so differently? Or why immigrant children quickly adopt their peers' language and accent rather than their parents? Judith Rich Harris's groundbreaking book, The Nurture Assumption, tackles these questions with a revolutionary thesis. Contrary to what most of us believe, parents have far less influence on their children's development than commonly thought. When it first appeared in 1998, Time magazine named it one of the year's most influential books, and it became a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. The book resonated with readers tired of parent-blaming theories and sparked fierce debate among developmental psychologists. Steven Pinker called it a turning point in the history of psychology, while others labeled Harris, a grandmother from New Jersey with no university affiliation, as having a hell of a nerve for challenging decades of established thinking. For over a century, developmental psychology has been dominated by what Harris calls the nurture assumption, the belief that what shapes children's personalities beyond their genetic inheritance is primarily how their parents raise them. This assumption underlies virtually all parenting advice, from Hillary Clinton's It Takes a Village to countless child development textbooks. The evidence supporting parental influence seems overwhelming. Clinical psychologists routinely trace adult psychological problems to childhood experiences with parents. Scientific studies show correlations between parenting styles and child outcomes. Loving parents have securely attached children, parents who talk to children have bright children, and parents who set firm limits have well-behaved children. But Harris argues this evidence doesn't actually prove what it appears to prove. The correlations between parent behavior and child outcomes could be explained by three alternative factors: shared genes, child-to-parent effects, where children's innate characteristics elicit certain parental responses, or neighborhood effects, where similar families cluster together. The nurture assumption originated with Freud, who traced adult psychological problems to childhood experiences with parents. Though behaviorists like John Watson and B.F. Skinner rejected Freud's specific mechanisms, they maintained his core premise that early childhood experiences determine development. Watson famously boasted he could pick any healthy infant and train them to become any type of specialist regardless of innate talents. Modern developmental psychology emerged in the 1950s when researchers began studying differences among children and tracing these to parental influences. Despite early studies finding few connections between parenting practices and children's personalities, thousands of similar studies followed, with those showing statistically significant results becoming published evidence for the nurture assumption, while unsuccessful studies were largely forgotten. Behavioral genetics research provides the most compelling evidence against the nurture assumption. By studying adoptees and twins, researchers can separate hereditary from environmental influences. The results consistently show heredity accounts for roughly 50% of variation in human psychological characteristics, with environment responsible for the other 50%. But here's the shocking part. Studies show that growing up in the same home doesn't make siblings more alike in personality. Shared genes account for similarities, but there's no evidence that shared environment creates additional resemblances. Even for characteristics like IQ, any environmental effects fade by adolescence, with correlations between adult adoptees raised together hovering around zero. This finding has been replicated across numerous studies. Identical twins raised apart are as similar in personality as those raised together. Adoptive siblings, despite sharing the same home environment, are no more similar than strangers once they reach adulthood. Even major differences in home environments have surprisingly little effect on children's development. Children of working mothers are virtually indistinguishable from those with stay-at-home mothers. Quality of daycare has little or no impact on most children's development. Children in unconventional family arrangements, whether communes, open marriages, single-parent households, or same-sex parent families, show no significant differences in adjustment compared to children in conventional families. Birth order represents a non-genetic difference in how parents treat their children. Firstborns receive undivided parental attention before being dethroned, while secondborns face competition from birth. Parents tend to be more anxious with firstborns and give them more responsibility. Despite these predictable differences in parental treatment, extensive research has found no consistent birth order effects on personality. If parents cannot modify their child's inherent personality, why does everyone believe they have important effects? Harris argues this is because children develop context-specific behaviors. They act differently in different environments, adapting their conduct, language, and emotional responses to suit each distinct social setting. Young children demonstrate remarkable behavioral flexibility across various social contexts. Babies of depressed mothers show dramatically different behaviors depending on their caregiver, appearing withdrawn and somber with their mothers, but animated and engaged with nursery caregivers. Similarly, toddlers often display contrasting behaviors at home versus daycare centers, perhaps being shy and clingy at home while social and independent at daycare. This adaptability extends to older children, who might be reserved at school but boisterous at home, or compliant with teachers but defiant with parents. Language acquisition provides the clearest and most compelling example of context-specific learning. Children effortlessly switch between languages and communication styles as they move between environments, demonstrating sophisticated social awareness. The children of immigrants typically answer their parents in English, even when addressed in the heritage language, a phenomenon known as language asymmetry. Their proficiency in the home language often remains at a basic level, while their English flourishes through peer interaction. This pattern holds true across diverse cultural and linguistic backgrounds, from Spanish-speaking households to Asian immigrant families. Remarkably, parents don't need to teach language at all. In many traditional societies, particularly in indigenous communities, mothers rarely speak directly to prelinguistic children, yet all eventually become competent speakers. Even children of deaf parents, who receive minimal verbal language input, become fluent English speakers, acquiring language primarily through peer interactions and community exposure. These cases powerfully demonstrate that children's language acquisition is driven more by peer group influence than parental instruction. Harris argues that personality has two distinct components: inborn tendencies that remain consistent across all environments, and environmental aspects that are specific to particular contexts. The environmental component includes both learned behaviors and associated emotional responses. For instance, if parents consistently made a child feel worthless, those negative feelings become specifically attached to home-related contexts but won't necessarily transfer to other environments unless similar treatment occurs there. A child might feel anxious and insecure at home, but confident and capable at school or with friends, showing how context-specific these learned responses can be. This understanding of context-specific behavior helps explain why children of troubled homes can often thrive in other settings, and why therapeutic interventions focusing on new environments can be more effective than trying to change the home situation. It also suggests that children's resilience stems partly from their ability to compartmentalize experiences and develop different behavioral strategies for different contexts. Harris proposes group socialization theory as an alternative to the nurture assumption. Her theory holds that children are socialized primarily by their peer groups, not their parents. Children identify with others their own age and gender, and they adapt their behavior to fit the norms of these groups. This process occurs through both explicit and implicit mechanisms, as children actively seek to understand and embody the characteristics of their peer group. By age 3, children can identify their gender and age category, forming the foundation for their socialization process. Children tailor their behavior to others they perceive as like me, demonstrating remarkable sensitivity to social categories from an early age. They quickly learn to recognize and adopt the mannerisms, speech patterns, and behavioral norms of their peer group. Groups operate by majority rules. Whoever comes with different behavior must change, creating a powerful force for conformity that shapes individual development. Even young nursery school children display sophisticated social awareness through their interactions. They delight in outwitting teachers by hiding forbidden toys or treats in their pockets and sharing them secretly with peers. These acts of defiance create a sense of groupness, us kids against the grown-ups. Children's cultures include strategies for mocking authority, private languages, and traditional games passed down through generations without adult involvement. These shared experiences and secret codes strengthen group bonds and create distinct child cultures that exist parallel to adult society. Children learn the rules of their society through both direct experience and observational learning. They watch what happens to other peers and adjust accordingly, developing a nuanced understanding of social expectations. Peers enforce conformity through various mechanisms, from subtle social cues to overt mockery and exclusion. The nail that sticks up gets hammered down. Research shows peer acceptance rejection has lasting effects on adult adjustment, influencing everything from self-esteem to social competence, while childhood friendships don't leave permanent personality marks. Gender categories emerge as the most important psychological groups during childhood, shaping behavior and social preferences from an early age. Even three-year-olds strongly identify as girls or boys and demonstrate clear preferences for same-sex playmates. By age 5, playgroups are almost completely sex-segregated, with children actively maintaining these boundaries. Children enforce gender norms rigorously through social pressure and explicit commentary. For example, a 4-year-old girl refuses to wear her favorite sneakers after being told they're boy shoes. These early experiences with gender categorization and enforcement have lasting effects on identity development and social behavior. The power of peer influence extends beyond immediate behavior to shape lasting attitudes and values. Children develop their understanding of appropriate conduct, social hierarchies, and group dynamics primarily through peer interactions. These experiences in peer groups create the foundation for later social relationships and continue to influence behavior well into adulthood, demonstrating the enduring impact of early group socialization. Harris challenges Margaret Mead's definition of culture as the systematic body of learned behavior which is transmitted from parents to children. When examining cultural transmission, immigrant families provide crucial evidence. When children of immigrants join peer groups of non-ethnic Americans, the parents' culture disappears quickly. Children become code switchers who toggle between cultures, speaking one language at home and another outside, but the outside culture invariably wins. Even when immigrant communities cluster together, allowing children to blend cultures initially, the original culture is typically lost within 3 generations, especially when families move away from ethnic enclaves. The deaf community demonstrates how language serves as a membership card for belonging to a certain tribe. American Sign Language, ASL, forms the foundation of deaf culture in the United States, creating a distinct cultural identity. Unlike other cultural groups, deaf culture cannot be passed down from parents to children, since most deaf children are born to hearing parents. Yet deaf culture remains robust, with deaf children typically acquiring their language and culture in schools for the deaf, often learning from the minority of students who come from deaf families. Harris argues that culture typically transmits not from parent to child, but from the parent's peer group to the children's peer group. Children who share a peer group often have parents who also share a peer group. When young children enter a peer group, they already have much culture in common because they come from similar homes typical of their neighborhood. The case of Larry Ayuso demonstrates how neighborhood environments shape children's behavior. At 16, Larry was failing school in the South Bronx, with friends lost to drug violence. After relocating to New Mexico through a program that moves kids from urban ghettos, he transformed into an AB student and basketball star. Research confirms this pattern. Children can be rescued simply by removing them from delinquent peers. British studies show delinquent London boys' crime rates decline when they move out of the city, even when moving with their families. Neighborhood composition matters more than individual family characteristics. Studies reveal that African American youth from high-risk families who live in middle-class neighborhoods show aggression levels comparable to their middle-class peers. In schools, children develop subtle ways to defy teacher authority while technically following rules, what sociologist Sharon Carr calls playing the fine line. These include the wastebasket saunter, disposing trash with exaggerated slowness, and split-body maneuvers, appearing engaged with upper body while socializing with lower body. These small rebellions are performed for other students who matter most to children's social experience. As children mature, they develop the ability to navigate multiple social identities, switching effortlessly between seeing themselves as members of various groups, third grade girl, smart kid, etc., or as individuals. Schools provide fertile ground for social categorization, with many possibilities for forming subgroups. Between parallel groups, contrast effects emerge. When teachers divide children by ability, tracking, the good readers tend to improve, while poor readers worsen due to group contrast effects. Harris challenges the traditional view that children mature by emulating adults. Instead, she argues children want to be successful children, not miniature adults. Children want to be like higher status peers, typically older or more mature children, rather than adults. This is evident in how younger children often idolize teenagers, copying their fashion choices, music preferences, and social behaviors, while showing relative indifference to adult role models outside their immediate family. Human children have a unique growth pattern: rapid growth in the first few years, a decade-long plateau, then a sudden adolescent growth spurt to adult size. This pattern worked well in traditional societies with only two age categories, children and adults, where clear rites of passage marked the transition between these states. But modern society has created intermediate categories like teenagers, who are physically adult-sized but socially not adults. Without clear transition rituals, these adolescents form their own distinct social category, creating potential for age group hostility. This ambiguous status is particularly pronounced in Western societies, where adolescents might physically mature at 13-14, but not take on adult responsibilities until their early 20s. The hostility teenagers show toward adults doesn't suddenly appear in adolescence, but has been developing earlier, especially among boys. Even sweet boys from respectable families use foul language with peers that would shock their parents. This dual personality, one for adults and another for peers, begins as early as elementary school. When teenagers are gathered together in high schools, they become a powerful social force, creating what Harris calls a mechanism for rapid social change. This explains why teenage culture can shift so dramatically from one generation to the next, often leaving parents struggling to understand their children's world. By high school, social groupings solidify into rigid categories based on personalities and abilities: jocks, brains, nerds, popular kids, and burnouts. These categories often transcend cultural and geographical boundaries, appearing in similar forms across different schools and countries. Harris emphasizes that many students don't choose their social categories, no one chooses to be a nerd, and are often forced into groups they'd rather not belong to. These categorizations can have lasting effects on personality development and social identity, influencing everything from academic performance to future career choices. The pressure to conform to these group identities can be intense, often overriding individual preferences and family influences. This social categorization serves an evolutionary purpose, helping adolescents find their place in the social hierarchy and develop the skills needed for adult life. However, in modern society, these categories can become unnecessarily rigid and potentially harmful, especially when they limit individual growth and potential. Despite her critique of the nurture assumption, Harris acknowledges that parents aren't merely wallpaper in their children's lives. Parents do influence what children learn at home, but this doesn't necessarily translate to personality formation. Children bring knowledge from home to their peer groups, retaining what aligns with peer values. While language and gender-appropriate behavior are strictly enforced by peer groups, talents, hobbies, and career interests generally aren't. Children learn piano playing, career knowledge, and political views at home, but they learn public behavior and self-concept from peers. Parents' most significant power is their ability to determine their children's peer group, especially in early years. By moving to different neighborhoods or selecting schools, parents can dramatically alter their child's developmental trajectory. Harris recommends placing children in schools with smart, hardworking peers where academic achievement is valued. Harris also recommends considering a move if a child is being severely bullied, since victims develop reputations that are extremely difficult to change within an established peer group. When a child has zero status and is miserable, relocating may be worthwhile, despite the usual disadvantages of losing one's peer connections. Harris challenges the conventional wisdom that parents should focus on building children's self-esteem. She argues that high self-esteem doesn't lead to success. Rather, success leads to high self-esteem. Research shows that efforts to boost children's self-esteem haven't improved academic performance or prevented risky behaviors. Genuine, portable self-esteem comes from one's status in peer groups, particularly at school. Children are acutely aware of their social standing, and low status can leave permanent marks on personality. Parents can't prevent negative typecasting in peer groups, but they can make it less likely by ensuring their children look normal and attractive, dressing them like their peers, addressing medical and dental issues, and avoiding giving them unusual names that might make them stand out. Harris argues that the nurture assumption isn't merely a harmless fantasy, but actively harmful. It has transformed children into objects of anxiety, with parents fearful that minor mistakes might permanently damage their development. Parents feel perpetually inadequate against impossibly high standards. Most troublingly, she argues, the nurture assumption has introduced an element of phoniness into family life, by making genuine expressions of love indistinguishable from obligatory ones prescribed by parenting experts. It has also hindered scientific progress by encouraging meaningless research correlating parental behaviors with child outcomes, rather than investigating truly important questions about peer dynamics, classroom environments, and how to help disadvantaged children. Harris acknowledges that many parents, especially those with young children, find her message unsettling rather than liberating. They want to believe they can significantly shape their children's personalities and improve their chances in life through dedicated parenting. She firmly states they've been sold a bill of goods. Parenting doesn't match its widely publicized job description, and sincere effort doesn't guarantee success. Good parents sometimes have difficult children through no fault of their own. Despite our technological advances in preventing physical diseases, we can't control all aspects of human development. Harris concludes with a liberating message. Children are not empty canvases on which parents can paint their dreams. She advises parents to love their children because they're lovable, not out of obligation, to enjoy them, teach what they can, and relax. How children turn out isn't a reflection on parental care. They belong to tomorrow. Since its publication, Harris's theory has gained growing acceptance both within and outside academia, particularly in fields like criminology, developmental psychology, and behavioral genetics. The theory's impact has been especially notable in challenging long-held assumptions about parental influence on child development. Beaver and Wright's comprehensive criminology research directly challenges the traditional assumption that parents cause delinquent behavior. Their studies, involving thousands of students across multiple school districts, found that after controlling for genetic factors, parenting practices showed negligible association with children's self-control as judged by teachers. The strongest predictor of a child's behavior was how their classmates behaved, with classroom misbehavior even affecting self-control at home, a finding that strongly supports Harris's group socialization theory. Their groundbreaking twin studies, which included both identical and fraternal twins raised together and apart, revealed substantial genetic contributions to teenagers joining antisocial peer groups, with no significant parental influence detected. Even more striking, they found that rather than core family functioning causing antisocial behavior in teens, it was the teenager's antisocial lifestyle that negatively affected family functioning, a clear child-to-parent effect. This reversal of causation challenged decades of assumptions about the direction of influence in parent-child relationships. A comprehensive 12-year study by Rees, Niederheiser, Hetherington, and Plomin examined 720 sibling pairs with varying genetic relatedness, including identical twins, fraternal twins, full siblings, half-siblings, and step-siblings, to identify what causes personality differences between siblings. The results strongly supported child-to-parent effects. When parents treat children differently, it's because the children are different first, due to genetic and peer group influences. The researchers found no evidence that differential parental treatment causes sibling differences, even in cases where parents showed clear favoritism or varying disciplinary approaches. Though many developmental psychologists still resist Harris's ideas, particularly those heavily invested in traditional parenting theories, the younger generation of researchers gives her hope for change. Their work increasingly incorporates peer influence and genetic factors into developmental models. One of her primary hopes was that she could make child-rearing less stressful for parents by relieving them of excessive responsibility for their children's outcomes. But this hasn't happened as intended. Parents, influenced by cultural pressures and ingrained beliefs, still largely adhere to the anxiety-ridden, labor-intensive style of parenting prescribed by their culture. Even her own daughters continue these practices with their children. But as Harris Riley notes, given her own theory about parental influence, why should she expect to have an influence on her own daughter's parenting choices? This ironic observation serves as both a personal validation of her theory and a reminder of how deeply entrenched traditional beliefs about parenting remain.